Hey, happy Sunday. Who is sick of hearing about me? I am definitely sick of hearing about me. I never want to talk about myself ever again. I mean, I'll keep talking about the Sicilian Inheritance, the greatest book of all time, but just me, Joe Piazza? So sick of that bitch. So today I'm going to share with you an interview with my best friend, my constant companion, my soulmate, the woman who married me in a vintage Halston dress in front of a Sphinx, none other than Glynis McNichol.
Welcome to Your New Life Blend. I'm Shoshana Hecht, and I'm so excited to be joined today by author, journalist, podcast host, and producer, Glynis McNichol, whose hotly anticipated new memoir, I'm Mostly Here to Enjoy Myself, is getting rave reviews. I am knee-deep in it and loving it, and so I can't wait to dig into that. But more on Glynis. A prolific and accomplished writer and creator, Glynis's work has appeared in the New York Times, The Cut, The Guardian, Elle, Town and Country, The Daily Beast, and the New York Daily News, among others. She writes frequently about New York City and has been in numerous best of collections for her incisive and often viral writing. Glynis also wrote, hosted, and produced the award-winning podcast Wilder, a reckoning with the legacy of Laura Ingalls Wilder for iHeartMedia. She also co-produced the podcast Under the Influence, hosted by Joe Piazza, another Your New Life Blend fave. Glynis is also the author of the memoir, No One Tells You This, one of the best books of 2018 per Esquire, the CBC, and the Financial Times, about living her life single, child-free, and happy at 40, and becoming her own role model in a cultural landscape that seems to think women stop existing if they don't get married and have kids. In her new book, Glynis expands on these themes of autonomy and joy in her account of her decadent post-pandemic summer in Paris, eating all the chocolate and doing other very fun, pleasurable things that she argues we all richly deserve, even women, especially women. I love Glynis's writing and how she so often will open up my mind to a new way of thinking or seeing the world, in particular in her willingness to tell you exactly how she sees it in her singular voice and style, and her unapologetic assertion that her own choices, life, and happiness matter now and always, and yours too. Glynis's intentionality in all of this is extremely Your New Life Blend, and I can't wait to talk to her about all of it. Welcome to the show, Glynis.
Thanks for having me. That was great. I ate more than chocolate that summer, but yes, that's always a good place to start.
It's a good place to start. I want to jump right into the book because I'm holding up the book and I've tabbed so many places, things that just really struck me. I mean, I love your writing so much, but
that's nice to see. I'm still adjusting to people reading it in the world because it's not out for another 2.5 months.
That's right. It's an advanced, uncorrected proof.
Very uncorrected. And yes, but which is another...
Yeah, that our co-producer, Rachel, had from Glynis and gave it to me to tear through. And I have to say, I'm almost done in 2 days. So just for the listeners to know, it is a beautiful read. It's a riveting read. And just the food thing alone, that's kind of what I was going to point to is like, yeah, one of the pages I flagged that I happened to flip through right before hitting record is how you talk about frying eggs in butter and the way you describe it. And it's not just, yeah, it's not just chocolate. It's the bread. It's the butter. It's the ooey gooey cheeses and the pleasurable food of Paris mm-hmm. and life. Yeah.
A friend of mine said when I asked her what she thought of all the sex in the book, and she was like, it's fine. I think the cheese is the porn. She's like, the food is the porn in the book and not the sex. And I thought, well, great. That's also nice to hear. I can't cook I literally don't cook anything. And so writing about food as a person who only understands food from the consuming end of the deal, I felt like I hope that I can do justice to the many pleasures that France provides in that department.
The whole book is it's a sensory soak. I mean, I don't know. Let's get it.
It's a good line. I'll put that on the book cover.
It's a sensory, like you really literally. Okay. This podcast, as you know, it's about living with intention, making decisions mm-hmm. for yourself, what we want our lives to look like. And often I think, and I still think this is true, that we're told as women pretty early on, like the messaging is that there's just a way to do it. But we know here at the show that that's not true. I myself married, divorced, did not have the happily ever after and remarried very happily. But like it didn't go at all the way I expected it to as a young person, as a teenager, right? Our co-producer, single mom, right? You know, just not really interested in the typical narrative. And then there's just not one way to do that. And that is like, that's your writing and your life is so much about like agency and priorities, right? So yeah, I want to talk about the sensory soak that is, I'm mostly here to enjoy myself and just like the way that you're living too, Glynis. So where to begin?
It's been interesting in the last few years because even when you said something about my turning 40, I'm turning 50 at the end of the summer, and 40 is beginning to sound young to me, inevitably, even though it didn't feel so at the time. And certainly I am sensitive to it not feeling so for many people, in the same way that I was at a dinner party the other night with everyone there was over the age of 60, and they sort of scoffed that when I said I'm turning 50, and they're like, oh, you're such a baby, which I don't actually think is a very useful framing of age because it's a little patronizing. And so I try to stay away from it. But I am also aware that culturally are approaching some of these what feel like predetermined expectations or cultural roles has shifted dramatically in the last 5 to 7 years. And that this is a very heteronormative narrative that I was feeling, I don't know if the word's pressured, but I was feeling very sensitive to. You know, I find the response to the book, not entirely, but is increasingly like, oh, it's interesting. What's the big deal? And I think, you know, in some ways, the progress that you hope was going to be made has been made. And in some ways, obviously, we know living in America that there's this extreme rollback happening around women and agency. So I think both of these things are happening at the same time. But I do think I try to be clear, particularly in this book, that a lot of what I'm responding to or thinking about are narratives that were handed to me as like, I think the phrase is heteronormative, like you're a woman, you'll grow up, you'll fall in love with a man, you'll get married, you'll have the wedding, you'll have the kids, whatever. And still so many of our rituals are based around that trajectory of events. But I think increasingly we're having a different discussion and there's a different vocabulary around so many experiences, not everywhere. And certainly as anybody with a shred of awareness of the news cycle can tell you, the pushback is violent and dangerous and against a lot of vulnerable people. But I think there's a lot of different things happening now that when I set out to write No One Tells You This, which I think I started writing that book not quite, little less than 10 years ago. So it's been an interesting trajectory.
I mean, I feel like I just read it just like not that long ago.
Well, it came out 6 years ago. It was a book about the year 2014 to 2015. Anyway, it's just sort of on my mind as we think these things through and who is feeling the pressure and what sort of pressure.
Yeah, I think the thing you say about aging really struck me. I took a note on that, the framing of it, because I always say getting older beats the alternative, right? Not everybody gets 50.
Yeah, I do think that this book is a lot more about aging than is about, I mean, I guess age and gender are very hard to separate because we do punish women for aging. That has not changed, I don't think, in very small ways. But this book is far more about the expectations and invisibility around age than it is necessarily around sort of the cultural norms of marriage and or partnering and parenthood.
Yes, I'm going to fist pump on that because it stuck out so much to me, Glynis, as I've been reading it. And, you know, maybe there's more to come in the last like 40 pages that I have left.
There's a spanker in the last 40 pages, so get ready.
I flipped ahead so that I would be oriented, but I'm going to go back and actually read. I did do a fast, so I'm aware. But
there's a paragraph from the end of that chapter missing in the galley, which is frustrating and amusing to me because the end of it seems so dramatic. And in reality, it was far more amusing. But anyway, when they say uncorrected proof, it does seem really dramatic, right? Yeah, it's not. It's not. There's a paragraph. It's too boring to go into why, but there was like, there's a paragraph missing in the galley from the end of that chapter. And a couple of people have reached out to me being like, what happened? Are you okay? And I was like, yeah, like it was just of the paragraphs to go missing in the book. It's amusing that one got lost.
It's very cliffhangery. And what's funny about it, there's that whole section where you're finding your way out of the forest. And I was like, okay, I know Glynis is okay, but I'm nervous. I wasn't, like the way you wrote it, I was like, I know she's fine, but like, I'm talking to her tomorrow in 2 days or whatever. But like, I was like, I was actually nervous for you. So it was well written because it was very.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. I sometimes tell people to take us off, but when people ask me what the book is about, you know, depending who you talk to, it's about age, it's about sex, it's about food, as we say, or agency. And I sometimes think, for me personally, it's a love letter to my bike because so much of my life and how I live is on a bike. And that bike ride I talk about in that chapter is hands down in my life one of my favorite, which is why, you know, it made it into the book. It was sort of a really incredible bike ride home that night.
It's beautifully written. Back just about the aging thing, because I had this thought a few times. It grew actually, this feeling of like every woman of every age should read this book, because it's not, I mean, because I have read more graphic sex in books than this, for sure. It's beautifully written, it is very sexy and all that. But what really struck me over and over again was how you saw yourself so differently, and your beauty and your desirability, and how that shaped how that changed the self-love side of it, your view of yourself.
Literally and metaphorically. Yeah, maybe we should tell people who are listening. I feel like we jumped ahead, but the premise of I'm Mostly Here to Enjoy Myself is after, it takes place in August and a little bit of September 2021, and comes at the end of a year to a year and a half of me being primarily completely alone in my very small Upper West Side apartment during COVID, during lockdown. And after, you know, we went into lockdown March 2020, and by June 2021, the vaccines had sort of rolled out, and there was this sense of an impending sort of re-release into life, which sort of started that summer. And right before the Delta wave, I sort of feel like in the action version of this movie, I had bought a plane ticket to Paris sort of out of desperation, and out of the stagnation of everything was punishing in another sort of way. And I had an apartment to stay in Paris. So I bought the plane ticket, and it sort of felt like as the plane was taking off, sort of the wave of Delta was coming in behind me. And it was this sense of like, I'm just going to go. And when I landed in Paris, the city was, I have a large community of friends here and I've spent a lot of time here. But when I landed, the city was completely free of tourists, which is unheard of, I would say, outside of times of war in the last 200 years. And the French who could had gone to their holiday homes for August as per usual. And so it was just this incredible experience of having Paris for Parisians and me. And Paris had just come out of sort of a much more restrictive lockdown. So everyone who was here was having this similar experience to me of just like, how quickly can I get out of my clothes? And how quickly can I get into life and like touch and sort of a hedonistic element of living, which the French already are much better at than most places. It's in those 5 weeks that I recount just pleasure and but the pleasure of friendship and the pleasure of community and the pleasure, like, is like corporeal the word for it? Like physical pleasure of food and obviously as much like nudity as much as possible. Mm-hmm. I think of my life as being determined by my ability to literally move. I ride my bike everywhere. I am able to leave sort of at will within, you know, the confines of limited funds, etc. But that's sort of what I was trying to capture in the book, and this sense of it happening in a moment where I was 40, I turned 47 in that book. This sense of you're headed into sort of the era age of women where you cease to see any version of yourself in the culture at all, and you are sort of not sort of, you are just encouraged to think of everything to come as just going to get worse. Your sexual appeal will diminish, your opportunity will diminish, your viability will diminish. And in my experience, it's been the complete opposite. And so, as usual, I'm wanting to just let people know.
Well, and back to that was my point about like, I feel like everyone should read this because it's like this unfolding. And there were several moments where you would look back at like older pictures and be like, I was so hot, you know, like pictures that we like, and we all do that, right? Like we're looking back and we're like, you know, the book is very fresh because I've just been reading it the last 2 days, but it's like,
oh, you know, it's great. I haven't done that. I'm doing the audio, but I get back to new. We should say this podcast. I'm actually in Paris right now doing this podcast.
That's right. Of course. Absolutely.
Only in so far as I fly back to New York this weekend, and I'm doing the audiobook week after next. So I will reacquaint myself with all of the sentences that could have been sharper. I'm sure that I will come back to and be like, what were you thinking?
I don't think so. I mean, I think, yeah, always, but it's riveting and pleasurable and enjoyable. Mm-hmm. Also, all these things that are just so like just so thought provoking to Glynis, like where just on this, where your friend is like picks the, as opposed to picking the picture where she looks, the photo where she looks the most alive or very alive, she picks the one where she looks more perfect. It wrenches the heart a little bit.
Because we all do it, yes. Too. I mean, I think sitting during COVID and just craving experience, just being like craving touch or craving being seen or whatever it is. And I'd be going back through photos and just think like, oh God, I remember seeing this. I mean, Rachel, obviously, it's a long history of me yelling at her for taking my photos so much. And then I'll go back and be like, wow, this is a great photo. But of course, at the time, you only see how terrible it is. And I just think like our enjoyment of ourselves is so stolen by ideas of what we're supposed to look like. To me, and I think I wrote a piece in the Times that sort of maybe got reworked into the book, this sort of, there's a 5-year gap between to having a photo taken of yourself and your ability to enjoy that photo. Like I wanted to offer myself the grace and the kindness to, even if I look at a photo and I think, oh, that like, just know, you know, enjoy it. And that, am I enjoying myself? I mean, certainly I miss my neck from when I don't actually miss anything. I'm having such a good time. It's very hard to even like to see photos and think like, I understand based on how we measure women's value in appearance that I looked amazing in 2012. But like, I wasn't amazing. I wasn't enjoying myself. And I'm having such a fantastic time. I'm trying really, really hard to make that gap be as small as possible or non-existent or not worry about it at all.
And again, just going back to, I mean, and you say that in the book and you're saying it now, and I think it's really important. And it's reminding me of what you touched on at the top, which is rights, access to care and support and equality. There is a threat and the rollbacks. The message of this book that is like just a through line for you feels more urgent than ever.
I think so. I know I said this a bunch when the last book came out, but I really think it may be even more relevant now, which is I was born in 1974, which is obviously the year after Roe was passed in America, and is also the same year that women were first allowed to have bank accounts and credit cards mm-hmm. in their name. Mm-hmm. And I look at the life I'm leading now in terms of the degree of agency I have over my own life. And I think I'm a direct result of all three of those things. And the result, one of the results of that is that I do not have to ask permission to do anything. I don't need a chaperone. I don't need someone to sign off on the, I don't need to check to make, like I can, and I don't need, I mean, when we say permission, we're really talking about, you know, the larger idea, the patriarchy is a phrase I'm not the biggest fan of just because it's so overused, but that mm-hmm. sense of like, who don't I not need, do not need permission from? And that is, it's that. And the fear of my being out of that control, like I'm not, and shame is so much a part of that. The shame of, oh, I'm eating by myself or I'm traveling by myself or I don't have to ask permission because in some ways permissions is a stamp of approval. I don't have to do any of these things. And I can't conceive of feeling bad about that. I think is a terrifying prospect to power structures that are based on women being kept in their place quite literally. And so it doesn't surprise me as, and I am very much one of many. I think that's always my frustration when I write about certain things that I'm doing is I'm not, and I look around and I'm one of an enormous group of people. It's like, I see women everywhere living similarly and we don't see that reflected in the culture in any great way. And I also see these rollbacks as a response to watching women be like, fuck yeah, this is fucking fantastic. Like Ezra Klein the other day did a whole podcast on dropping fertility rates. And I enjoy his podcast. And he's certainly, you know, a very progressive voice. And still he was like, well, I don't quite understand. And I'm like, what if the answer is just women are for the first time discovering what it's like to have a life outside these roles and they're really enjoying it. And maybe that's just it. Maybe it's not. Maybe that's as simple as it is, and it's so new still. And the reason people are having less children or no children is because, wow, this is, you know, so dazzling in certain ways. And in certain ways, it's, you know, just as hard as anything else. So I just, it's really interesting to sort of be on the crest of that wave and recognize that you are and see how and sort of understand so much of overturning of Roe, this push to make no-fault divorce not a thing, the trad wife movement is really in response to, oh my God, they actually don't need us. They're having a really good time. And holy shit, how do we get them back inside the house?
Right. And also all the other larger forces too, like what's happening with the climate and like.
Yeah, the irony of it, we're finally arriving at, and these things are completely connected, that we're finally arriving at a moment where sort of women, and certainly in the past, women have been able to travel, but so much of that is tied to money. So the last 75 years tied to money, and certainly you've only had birth control for the last 50, and now all these things are tied together. And you're like at this moment where this sense of like, oh, we can finally do everything, of course, collides with climate change, which is just the upheaval around it. And not just, I mean, being in Europe right now, I mean, we're not unaware of Russia and the States, but there's a proximity reality to being here that shifts that a little bit too. So yeah, this is all happening at the same time. And certainly that summer, even though it predates Dobbs, it didn't predate it enough. It's not that we didn't know this was coming, and it's not like all these other things weren't at play too. And having been in New York City for the last 25 years or whatever, this awareness of how fortunate I'm able to do what I'm able to do, and how fortunate that I'm a person who's completely set up personality and life-wise to do it, is able to take advantage of it in this moment, and how rare it is, and the absurdity of ever feeling any shred of shame about it. Because it's not the epilogue. Is it the epigraph? The little quote you put at the beginning of a book?
I think that's what it's called.
Yeah, epigraph. I think so. I was getting confused. Yeah. The epigraph in this, one of the epigraphs is from The Handmaid's Tale. Did you read The Handmaid's Tale?
Ages and ages ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if you remember. Some people don't remember because I think a lot of people watch the show now. But in the novel, The Handmaid's Tale, there is an epilogue where you realize that the whole book is actually, they're at an academic conference in the future, and someone has found this diary in a wall, and they're debating the veracity of Offred's tale. Was it representative of how women lived at the time in a widespread way? And there was part of me when I wrote all this down, being so aware of how precarious the life I'm leading is in terms of like all of the forces at work right now. I just thought I should write it down in case it does get shoved in a wall somewhere, just as like evidence this was possible for a brief period of time if we go careening back into the way things have been for women and for most people for most of history.
Oh, so many things to talk about. I mean, I do want to name. Yeah, thank you. I think of you as someone who has a high tolerance for risk.
I do have a high tolerance for risk, yes. Some might say too high a tolerance.
Some might, but I don't know. I don't know. If you're
at least I know how to benefit from it. I do have that conversation. I know it's in the book, Josh, but I do have that conversation. Rachel and I have had that conversation. Like a high tolerance, people who are rewarded for having a high tolerance of risk oftentimes have a high bank account number, and I think that neither. There are times where I'm just like, it's privileged to have a high tolerance for risk, right? Because it's not, there's so many factors at play in that, including health.
That's right. Thanks for saying that, because there's a little bit of a luxury to like, what's it like to not feel anxious about all the things? I mean, you have taken some big risks. And I think you wrote about that, Rachel, you know, co-producer of the podcast. She's like, remember that piece she wrote? I think we're alone now. Welcome. Right. Which really in for the New York Times at the beginning of like early 2020, where it was like,
I was like, some of us have been living like this for quite some time. Listen, there's a lot of anxiety. I do have a high tolerance for risk, and that is partly me, and I can claim that. But I'm aware of certain things that have allowed me to foster that. But certainly at the beginning of the pandemic, where many, many people are like, this was not in my 5-year plan. And I thought, wow, what a luxury to have a 5-year plan.
I mean, I coach people all the time on like having a target, not the end, but an end, like something you're working towards. And often I will anchor people in like 3 to 5 years. But I also add in that we evolve, because this is humans and because stuff happens to us, right? So that's the thing we talk about here a lot on this podcast, is like we, you know, we make plans, we live intentionally, we design our lives, but also like, what do we do when life throws all kinds of stuff at us?
This is specific to my choice to be a writer in a world where the media industry has been collapsing at an ever increasing rate for the last 15 years. I think some of the anxiety I feel right now is there not being a place. There's nowhere to aim because it doesn't exist. And that, I think, is a real thing that a lot of people who are in media at large are suffering from, too. There's no far off goal to aim at and say, you know, 20 years ago or 25 years ago, you could have said, I want to be Maureen Dowd, or I want to be Frank Rich and have, I remember Frank Rich. I was like, oh, I want to do that. I want to have one 1200 word column once a week. That's like fun and smart. And like, that's the goal. And of course, these things don't exist anymore. And there's nowhere to point. And I think that probably is what some people experienced for the first time during the pandemic, of like, oh my God, what is this world? And if you've been living in an industry that has been shifting to the degree that media has, you know, for the last 15 years, I think that felt more familiar. And then add to that the fact I don't have any outside support systems. The fallback is you.
Let's speak to that a little bit too. I want to just name, and we'll come back to this, but I want to stick with this about what you just mentioned, which is, you know, the book, you think it's going to be a romp, but it really is very serious also. It is a sensory soak, but it is,
right.
It is serious. Like these things that were, like it is a very-
I think enjoyment is serious. I think-
Agree, but it also explores these much deeper questions about how we get to see ourselves, how we get to live, you know, what are the kinds of stories that are uplifted for women and men, right? About what's possible for women, like how do we all, you know, work together. So yeah, pleasure is serious, agree. Mm-hmm. And dude, there's a lot of layers
and there is some romping.
There's y'all, the romping is good. The romping is good.
There's an ass on the cover of this book for a reason.
There is. You know, she's rolling around naked on her furs. It's great. It's amazing. When it's all you, you're an orphan, I guess.
Yeah, I suppose I am. It's hard to say I'm an orphan when I'm almost 50. That just feels sort of...
It's an odd thing to say, but I think it's...
Like a natural aging thing. But I did not come from a family situation in which there was any... security, financial or emotional or otherwise. And so when we talk about tolerance for a risk, there's a potential for failure too. And I'm sure those two things are tied together in ways that if I could afford therapy, I'd probably unpack. Instead, I just keep writing books about myself. Yeah, it's complicated. It is complicated. I really, and it has a lot to do, the older I get, the more I'm aware of, like, so much of this has to do with health, right? Touch wood, I've been in good health, and I'm increasingly just so aware of when I was 25 and in good health, I didn't think twice about it. But when you're 50 and in good health, every mammogram, you know, the waiting period between the mammogram and the test results is a little bit of a life, what's a ghost of Christmas future? It's a little bit ghost of Christmas, where you're just like, oh, if this goes badly, especially when you're in America. And I say that because the conversation, you know, I'm in France where they really do have comprehensive health coverage and nothing is ideal. And as a Canadian, I know how the Americans can idealize Canadian health coverage, but like really understanding the penalties for health issues in the United States and the bankruptcy. And have you read Annie Ernaux? She won the Nobel Literature Prize last year. She's an amazing writer who writes a lot of memoir-esque stuff and has done for decades. She's French. And someone said, I just love her writing so much. It's just incredible. And I just thought like, and some of her books are really like 50 pages. It's amazing. And I'm so aware of like, and I don't know the details of her life, but I'm like, no one could make this career in the States because I'm like, she also had comprehensive health coverage, which makes a huge difference when you're wanting to devote your art to something.
It's true. I mean, in between every mammogram, I now think, because I am 50, I always think, is this the time my life changes? You know, like that thinking has increased as
every
I have
year.
Gotten older
that
every
piece
year.
You mentioned from the Times, it's okay to want to be, not want to be alone, whatever they end up with the title. It was a piece I started writing before COVID, and I think the title got shifted maybe, but it came out of going to get a breast biopsy and going by myself out of habit and needing someone to take me home, but also the punishment of being in that alone and me really thinking through like, you're a little bit cavalier about how much you're able to do alone. And you need to think through what that starts to look like going forward. And just like that. And also, I mean, not for nothing, just like what that looks like when with your health insurance, when you are the only, you know, I joked that I went to every Christmas party this year and asked people how they were making money as a writer because I thought I was missing something again.
I was at one of those parties. I remember you saying it.
Yeah, I was like, and what do you do? And the answer is always the same. They're married to it, or it's family money, or someone else's health insurance is relieving that. And that those are all real concerns in the States where they're not, you know.
It's true. I mean, I am married to a Canadian and we talk a lot
about...
I didn't
know he was Canadian.
Oh, yeah.
That's crazy. I didn't know that.
Really?
Yeah. No, wow. I can't believe I didn't know that.
I can't believe that either. I'm stunned.
Rachel's dropping the ball on her Canadian
Her Canadian connections. Well, but we talk, and his family's in Toronto and what, but we talk all the time about how though the healthcare is idealized there, like if there was a catastrophic illness, the level of stress is just different there because of that. I think having healthcare
The thinking is different.
Yeah, the thinking is different.
It's very, I mentioned this in the book in one of the chapters, but one of my coping mechanisms for how obscene the healthcare is in the States is just telling French people about it and then watching the look of horror. They don't believe it. And, you know, trying to explain copays and deductibles and what this
premiums
and the whole shebang. And they just don't believe you. And it's their disbelief that somehow comforts me in really remembering.
You're not crazy. The system's crazy.
It's almost like being in a, you know, it's like the analogy, I suppose, in some ways is being in an abusive relationship where it's like the gaslighting is so extreme and you sort of need someone else, like the outside view, to be like, no, this is really as bad as I think it is.
One thing I want to hit on, because I think just talking about the family on your own and it's all on you, is I think therapy and writing about it, but I also think too the pleasure of community, like that's a real through line for you too, like supporting women, talking to women, building a community of women. And like, it's the co-producer of the podcast, Rachel, editorial producer. I mean, you guys were co-founders of a women's network, which was a huge, that you sold in 2020, called The List, right? But ran it for almost 10 years. I think that's a real through line for you, right? I got invited to join, which was like kind of a game changer in my life. I was key in my life after moving to New York. Huge.
What year did you move to New York?
I moved to New York in 2011, but got introduced to it mid-2000s and joined in 2017. So yeah, it was like a whole revolutionary and deeply impactful.
This is nothing new, but I think the language around female community, which, you know, in my mother's day was like the Tupperware community, and in my grandmother's day was church community, shifted a lot. And I think alongside that has shifted, you know, Raina Cohn has a book out. Let me Google the title of it, actually, because it's such a good... The Other Significant Others, Reimagining Life with Friendship at the Center. I think what we've seen emerging, you know, in the last 10 to 15 years, particularly as people get married much later, is, you know, friendships playing a key role, a key support pillar, and there's no real recognition around that, and there's no language around that or a ritual necessarily. And all of these sort of communities in whatever form they're taking, or friendships, personal friendships in my life, and in the case of The List, that was a crossover of the two, is adding, you know, scaffolding or infrastructure or ways to officially recognize these relationships and how important they are. Because I think traditionally it was, you moved into marriage, you moved straight from the house into marriage, and the girlfriends you had, you sort of stayed in touch with, but they were not your pivotal support systems in really punishing ways. So because my friendships are so pivotal and have been, I'm constantly trying to recognize them for that. And I think, again, in the last 5 to 6 years, and probably longer than that, what we've seen is, you know, a cultural, longer than that, that's the whole premise of Sex and the City, right? Even though their entire goal is we want to have sex and get married, really, that's a show that's largely about the importance of female friendship in adult lives, not in I'm in college. So it is a through line, because that's been my experience. And I think that my experience is not unique by any means at all. I think actually, Shoshana, my experience is not unique across the board. I'm not that unique. And partly what compels me to write about these things is the frustration of knowing I'm not unique, and the loneliness that comes from not seeing yourself in a culture, and then the frustration that comes from knowing you're one of many. Not, you know, this is not an iconoclastic.
That's it, Glynis. I mean, that way to bring it back around for me, because that is you went exactly where I was thinking, which is, I don't remember if this, I don't think it's in the book. It's hard when I'm prepping for these to remember exactly where I read what you said, but
I can't remember things I've written, to be clear. I'm like, where did I read that? Oh, I wrote it. Oh, okay. But like, yes.
I think this was from your newsletter, where it was like the feedback you got from No One Tells You This was like, you think you're unique, lady, like whatever.
Always.
But like, you couldn't see yourself. And I think that's what's really important about this, is I think you're right. Like, people are living this way, but it's not messaged. We're not soaking in it the way we're soaking in other messages. And I think it's for that reason, like, one of my favorite coaching questions and questions for life is like, what more is possible for us? What are the ways that we can live this one life that we get, hopefully for like a good, long, healthy time?
Yeah. You know, when you said that we're not seeing it in the culture, Sarah Schulman, who's an amazing writer and obviously an activist and a novelist, when Roe was overturned, she wrote a piece in the New Republic, and there's a quote from it, which I will read to you and you can cut out if you want, but it really stuck with me. She said, "Men have had almost exclusive control of how women are represented since forever. And today, women creators and gatekeepers consciously or unconsciously replicate those distortions in order to stay in the game. The obstacle is that in the US, we confuse familiarity with quality. So when writers try to bring in truly complex work from women's point of view, the newness of the material creates anxieties in producers, publishers, and other gatekeepers, which they may not even understand themselves. And I've thought about that. I think about, I mean, that influenced a lot of, and you'll see in the last chapter when you get there, like they're thinking of, because as a person who has somewhat frequently been told the narrative I'm trying to convey is not a narrative, or it's not worthy of a story, or we don't understand, like, what's your instigating instigant? How do we know you're happy? Like, where is this ending? How do we know you have an ending if you're not, if the ending is not, you know, I always say at the end of the hour, the birth canal, like, how do we understand women's lives outside of this as value props? How do I understand it outside of a value prop? Like, this is very, very, I could be and am and was in that summer so, so excited, but it's so hard to almost believe in your own enjoyment when you can't see yourself, when there's nowhere to point, there's no language to point to. So I do, it did happen so much with No One Tells You This, where I would hear from people, they'd be like, do you think you're the first woman to ever not get married and not have kids? And I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. Like, I mean, but point me to the movie that says that, like, as the only one I ever think of is an unmarried woman, which is not available for streaming. It's a constant frustration.
Yeah, I just lost my headphones.
And on that note, you need a drink after this.
I just like, oh, hold on, let me get myself back together.
I mean, it is the wine hour here, so
yeah, I know we have to wrap. Like, but I could just like, I mean, honestly, could talk about like that alone for ages and ages, and like how no one tells you this should be a movie, and it isn't, because of exactly everything you just said. I read that, you know, like I know why. And you know what image popped in my head when I was reading that, and then we have to tell everyone what lipstick you're wearing. Was it Real Women Have Curves where she walks off? Does that? Do you remember that? Is that America Ferrera's? Like, is that the movie where she got famous? Am I remembering?
Maybe, but that? I even just hate that title. Like, I really...
I know, of course, but it's...
I hate that the title... No shade on anyone involved in that. I recognize where that...
And it was old, and it was a while ago. Yeah.
Yeah, this sense of, like, you have to be defiant. Like, you have to, like, I'm defiant because I have curves, as opposed to just... I remember when the first season of Girls came out. I mean, it's shocking to think about how shocking it was that Lena Dunham allowed her body to be seen on TV, and that she was sexually, you know, viable and not ashamed of herself. And, like, how... I remember Elizabeth or Emily Nussbaum writing a piece about that in Girls. Like, it was absolutely shocking. And so when you say something that, like, you know, Real Women, all of this stuff, all of this, like, it's just, why can't it be, as opposed to it be the plot point? Do you know what I mean? Like, why can't it just be? Because it is, it just is in our lives. It's not like I walk around being like...
As I remember it, that was the point of the movie, where she walks off into the sunset just owning herself and not into, like, not into it, not in a relationship, not into anything. You're reminding me of, like, one guy I dated that I loved, between husbands. He just said to me, like, he said, you have to understand that, like, any woman can go home at a bar with anyone she wants at any time.
I know this is, but I have to say, not like, I certainly, there's some element of that in this book,
mm-hmm.
but the fact it took me until my mid 40s to fully mm-hmm. grasp that mm-hmm. is such a it's not a condemnation of me. It's a condemnation of the entirety of the culture that is geared towards us feeling inferior in every way possible, to the point where I was shocked to discover this. And now I'm just like, now I know, continue to know and enjoy the reality of that. But like, it was so shocking to me that it's so enraging that it's a shock.
But that's what, so that's my point. Deeper, many layers to this narrative, like to this book.
Well, when,
like,
you think about the way we think about sexually viable, you know, older women, it's funny, I think our understanding of age has, and I'm not saying this, you know, because I want it to be true, excuse me, I don't actually care, but I do think our understanding of age in women has shifted dramatically in the last 15 years, so that when I say I'm an older woman, I think, I mean, I guess I am an older woman if you're 25, but it used to be a sexually viable older woman was a comedy trope, you know, like it was a punchline, that it was like, what was that, Courtney?
Cougar Town,
or, you know, the older woman who was like, even Peg on Married with Children, or you're sort of like the dangerous witch, and we could, it was so...
Or a desperate housewife.
Desperate housewives. And when I look at these tropes now, I understand it is a way to diminish, either through comedy or derision or fear, a woman in fully in prime. Like, I feel so powerful and so just at my absolute best. And when I look around and see, it's, I recognize what's going on, is, you know, that this has probably always, maybe not always, been true, because I haven't had I exist in a world with birth control and subsequently have not given birth to 15 children. What did Edra Klein say something the other day on that podcast? He said something like, well, if you look back, you know, 50 or 60 years ago, women with not that much money were having lots of children. And in other parts of the world, women who are poor are having lots of children. And whoever he was talking to was like, yeah, they don't have access to birth control. Like, it was just this moment of like, do you think if you had a time machine and you went back 100 years and said to a woman with 13 children, oh, you could have access to birth control? And she'd be like, no, this was great. I really... Like, you know, I might prefer this.
Yeah.
But it's like, you look at the, what you, anytime you see something that's like geared to make you feel ashamed or like turn you into a joke, it's, it always to me at this point is just such a commentary on how powerful you actually are.
That's right. If people are trying to tighten the...
Or make you feel bad about yourself. When I was on book tour for No One Tells You This, I still got, I mean, I got asked constantly, how do you eat by yourself? And I thought, how do you know you're living your life well if you don't eat by yourself? Like, I just couldn't conceive of that. And I was shocked at the, you know, these successful women all asking me this question. And I was like, who benefits from your feeling bad about eating by yourself? All the dudes you're eating with you don't actually want to be eating with is probably the answer.
That's a whole, I don't even know. Let's wrap. Let's wrap. Because again, then we can talk about like our need for distraction and whatever. Where can we find you and continue to follow and enjoy everything that you're sharing? Honestly, I try to read everything Glynis writes because it's amazing. And the lipstick, we have to know, like,
this lipstick today,
it's signature red lip. It's always a red. It's not always the same red, I assume. But yeah.
Maybe I wrote that in the newsletter. I get confused. My forever red that I always go back to is Max Russian Red, which is iconic red lipstick. But that's not what I'm wearing today. I am wearing McGrath, Pat McGrath, which I don't know why I brought it with me to Paris, but I put it on the other day when I went out and I was like, this is a great lipstick. I've forgotten. And the name of the lipstick is McGrath 418. And I either wear this or I wear NARS Jungle Red, or what's my other one? They have a sort of a little handful of ones. But Pat McGrath, I guess when people were obsessed with Taylor Swift's lipstick, It came out that she was wearing Pat McGrath's Elson, which she did a line where she named the lipsticks after models, I believe, and Karen Elson is. But she did a red lipstick named Elson, and it looks so good on Taylor Swift. And I was like, oh, I'm going to track that down. I'm going to get it. Looks great. But once that story ran, it sold out everywhere. Everyone wanted Taylor Swift's Pat McGrath Elson lipstick. And I was like, ah, all right. Well, it's not like I don't have 40 lipsticks in my medicine cabinet. And the next day I was in the medicine cabinet looking for something, and I realized I owned Elson Pat McGrath lipstick, and it had just been sitting in the medicine cabinet for like a year. And when I put it on, I was like, oh, I don't know it's here because it doesn't look good on me. But it was such a funny moment where I was just like, you're ahead of yourself. It's like when you go to look for something and you're like, where did I leave it? You've left it in the exact right space for yourself. And then you know, like I had already done my red lipstick diligence. And then I was like, oh, I should give this to someone because
they'll want it. And not every red looks good on everybody. So it's good.
Much like that was part of the skincare newsletter I sent out where I was like, it's great to follow skin influencers and we all love different stuff. But like skincare is like birth control. It's whatever works. Just it's very personal at the end of the day. And just it moisturize is. And wear sunblock.
Where are we following along?
Oh, right. My
getting
Instagram
your great.
No-
yeah, you're great. Your the review,
well, I mean,
the
reviews, like,
and one more thing, the review, and the, but the reviews are pouring in. It's amazing, and like people need to know. So tell us.
I did. You know, it's early days still, but Kirkus did give the book across the board rave review. Not even the thing where they most reviewers are like add in three lines of why it was just such a good review, which is mostly, it's more a relief than anything else. And as I said at the beginning, I'm only just adjusting right now to the fact that people I don't know are reading the book. It's like that strange leap you go from a small group of people having read every word to like, oh God, it's out in the world. But you know, Kirkus, I'm sure it's, you know, it's a weird little book. So I'm glad you're enjoying it.
It's not a weird little, it's a singular book, unfortunately, maybe.
Singular is really good, a good word too. Well,
it's
done.
It's singular and it's beautiful and it's important. It's deep, like it's layered, people. Like you want to get your hands on it.
There's depth. Kirkus said that too, Shoshana, so thank you. They said there's depth. That doesn't mean there's depth to the book, which I like hearing. I mean, it's not Emily in Paris for any number of reasons. And also too, it captures this, what I've realized now, having been back in Paris so much since then, it captures this very strange moment of empty Paris, which I'm not sure, you know, it's just like a very magical sort of time where how many people in history have had Paris to themselves at night, which is, speak about that chapter of me on the bike was part of that.
That's
chapter.
Right. That's right.
So they'll find website, glynismcnichol.com, Instagram, No One Tells You This, And I have a newsletter called Good Decisions on Substack.
Deeply rooted in this book. About, I mean,
it's a chapter. The title of that newsletter comes from what friends of mine and I used to say to each other whenever we make a good decision. We'd be like, oh, good decision. Because yeah. I don't think on a very basic level, women are often rewarded for making decisions on their own behalf. And I was like, good decision. And that's on Substack. And also there's a link to it on the website.
We're going to link to it all in the show notes. Mm-hmm. So it'll all be there.
What's your best decision, Shoshana?
Oh, best decision?
Well, what's one of your best decisions?
Wow, that's a stumper.
This should be, I should have this as a reoccurring feature. The newsletter is only like 2 months old, so I'm still sort of lurching around in it to see what feels right, but that might be.
Starting this podcast was an excellent decision. It exists because of Rachel Sklar, producer. She was on me for, I think, a year. She was like, this is a podcast. Yes, you can do it. And you would be amazing. And I'm not just saying that because she's producing on this episode right now, listening in. But it's actually true. It's actually the first thing that flew into my head.
There's a long list of people who could say this good thing I did exists because Rachel suggested it. Someone ever suggested to Rachel to have a testimonial page.
Definitely. And I have said it before, I say it again, like it exists because of her. And it's changed, like it's shaped me. The feedback's really nice from it. I get amazing guests like you. And it's really helping me, I think, form, you know, like just like deepen this point of view about like, what is it, something I've been coaching on for years, mm-hmm. but really came alive in the pandemic. And also, I don't know, like there've been so many where I just took matters into my own hand, like leaving a career and taking a like that pay cut and transitioning into the other thing, and all roads have led to the same. So I think you should have that as a feature. Get some good pull quotes for the newsletter.
I know.
For that.
I think so too.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. This is all good practice. You can tell, as I'm sure anyone listening to this podcast is, that I'm still figuring out how to talk succinctly about this book, but
I was riveted on hanging on every word. But so anyway, so thank you for testing it out with us, and thanks for being here, and thanks everyone for listening. This has been your New Life Blend. I'm Shoshana Hecht, reminding you, as ever, to be gentle with yourself.